Thank you. Good morning, everyone, and welcome to ARSC. As a conference manager, I am honored to introduce our first plenary session on what I call musical recycling. The gentlemen on this morning's panel constitute some of the lions of our profession. In the beginning, there was Harry Smith, but it is the members of this group that introduced me to the music that I've spent the last 40 years researching. For a young researcher just getting into the study of 78 RPM records, these individuals, through their reissues, ignited a spark in me that has resulted in a lifetime of exploration of traditional musical styles. There are some who are sadly not with us, including Biograph's Arnold Kaplan, Yazoo's Nick Pearls, and my own personal mentor, Origin Jazz Library's Bill Givens, whose label, one of the first to reissue early country blues 78s, I now run. But as I turn the dais over to David Giovannone, I think this group deserves a big round of applause for the monumental contributions they have made toward the study of the music we are so passionate about.
We're going to do this in two shifts today. We're going to do the folks who are up here for about a half an hour, then we're going to bring in a new shift, because these guys are old and they get tired really easily, you know. Then we'll bring in the younger guys. And there's a couple ways to do this, because there's a couple modes of preservation and access that have been going on for some time. The National Recording Preservation Plan sort of focuses on one, the institutional preservation, the institutional access, the assumption that this would mostly be done through public or grant monies. But to be quite honest, it's the privately funded, private initiatives, the commercial initiatives that have brought more music, preserved more music, brought those artists forward into the present day than most institutions combined. And we have a lot to learn from them, I believe. And that's what I want to extract from my good friends up here today. Maybe some stories about how they got started, but also, what can we learn from them in our, that we can apply in our institutions as we try to sustain these, as you, the professionals, I'm a collector, as you try to sustain these sorts of endeavors and move into an area that they've been serving quite well for decades. Rich, let me begin with you. Tell us who you are, what you do.
Well, my name is Richard Nevins. I associated with Shaughnessy at Yazoo Records. Okay, I guess we're going to have to, because we thought we could put it in the middle, but. Rich Nevins, associated with Shaughnessy and Yazoo Records, and Shaughnessy is for live contemporary recordings. Yazoo has been a label for reissues going back to 1967 when it was started by Nick Pearls and Bernie Kletzko. Shaughnessy has been doing it since the 80s, since the 1980s. That's it.
I'm Dave Freeman, and associated with County Records, mainly for the purposes of this meeting, I suppose, though I also am involved with Rebel Records, which we took over, County took over in 1980. I got interested in collecting. I was a collector first, and only got into the business because of, I was inspired by some records put out by Origin Jazz Library. And I lived in New York, found those records, and it was something entirely new to me, and I really appreciated what they were doing. And I thought, why couldn't I do something similar with country music or old time music, is what my main interest in collecting was. I liked the blues too very much, but I couldn't afford to collect both. Country records and blues records, especially the way blues records were. So basically, that's what we do. We still have a reissue series in the County Records and reissuing old-time music, and still run a label for new artists, which is mostly bluegrass. and that's our Rebel label.
Well, my name is Chris Strachwitz, and I guess I started in 1960. I was inspired by hearing Lightning Hopkins one day in person in 1959 in a Houston, Texas beer joint, and I'd met him that afternoon, and he said, come on over and play with us. Mac McCormick, my amazing guide to Texas, took me there. And he was wailing away on his guitar and singing about how personal things were, how aching his shoulder was, how he was hurting, how he couldn't get to the job almost because he couldn't see the chuck holes in the road because the rain-covered highway. And then he pointed at me, whoa, man, this man come all the way from California just to hear Paul Lightning sing. And I was just so impressed by this guy improvising, and he had an audience that was very small, just a few people, and they would jive back to him. I mean, he was playing ferociously on his electric guitar. I said, oh my God, I've got to record this in a beer joint. Unfortunately, I never succeeded, but the next year when I came with a tape recorder, he was booked to play the Berkeley Folk Festival and was leaving the next day. So anyway, that's how I started Arhuli Records when Mac and I went to Navasota, Texas, and found the great songster Mance Lipscomb there. That was my very first record, actually. And over the years, I guess it didn't take me very long before I saw the Harry Smith anthology, of course, and I think Origin was already happening. I forgot. Anyway, I decided we ought to liberate some of these old blues records, and so I started the Blues Classics label. And I paid Memphis Minnie, who was at the time in a nursing home in Memphis. She was found by a British singer, a wonderful lady singer who died since then. God, what was her name? Does anybody remember? Joanne Kelly, exactly. And that sold extremely well. And so I kept going. The next one was the Jug, Juke, and Washboard Bands, and then came the Sonny Boy Williamson. And I think it really helped me sell Arhulis because the money from the reissues at that time was really quite nice. And over the years, I've acquired other labels, including Harry Oster's folk lyric label. Harry Oster did a lot of wonderful recordings in Louisiana, primarily, of all kinds of Cajun music, including ballads and so forth. And so when the CD came about, no, it was already, I think it already started in the LP era. I used the folk lyric label to reissue ethnic music of various kinds, including Mexican music, did a long series on border music, and I forgot what else I did on LP. But during that time, I also started old-timey records, which, especially Cajun music, although I started with an anthology that really drove people crazy, I think, because I just included a bunch of stuff I liked. And it included a wonderful Nathan Abshire selection where the drummer was just bashing away. They were obviously all lit up and having a fantastic time on that record. Anyway, the Western Swing series I did on old-timey, the Cajun stuff and the Mexican. No, the Mexican stuff was on folk lyric. Anyway, we didn't call it booting. My good friend Ed Denson, this was a time of, you know, Mao Zedong and the Little Red Book. We called it, let's call it liberating the people's music. And we thought that was just a great idea. So that's what I pursued ever since, liberating the people's music. I pay them whenever I can find them. Okay.
That's great. I think that, Chris, you've already addressed this. So let's start with you, Dave, on the next question. You all do current talent and reissuing of the old records. Can you tell me how those two work with each other? Was doing both necessary? Did one support the other?
Well, I don't know if it were necessary. When I started old time, the county label was just reissuing classic old 78s. And after I had about four albums out like that, and they were all anthologies of fiddle music and mountain blues and so on, Charlie Ferreau approached me. I didn't know him. He was a friend through Bill Vernon, late Bill Vernon. And Charlie came to me with some field recordings of banjo, old-time banjo, that really impressed me, and said, why don't you put out a record of it? And at that time, I had no inclination to do anything except reissues. But the Wade Ward, Kyle Creed, Fred Cockrum, the people that I were introduced to by Charlie Ferreau, provided the impetus to do that. And we started with actually the first three or four records that we put out on our 700 series, which was new recordings. They were all done by Charlie Ferreau, including a bluegrass record of Larry Richardson. So that's about basically, and then both the reissues, which was our 500 series, and the new recordings, our 700 series, they just went on from there.
That's a record collector talking, the 500 series, the 700 series, right?
Right.
The 23,000s, yeah. Rich?
Well, they don't necessarily have to interact together, but in some cases, some scenarios, you need the income from the new recordings to fund some of the historical projects that you passionately like to do. Some reissues make money. Most of them don't. Maybe in the long term they break even or make a little. The ones I've always loved most myself have tended to be big money losers. But I really didn't care. And if there's any, you talked at the beginning about, is there any message to convey?
Yeah.
Here it is. I mean, if you want to get something done, you have to passionately be committed to it, passionately love it, be committed to it. Don't sit around waiting for funding. Just do it. That's it. If you love something, do it. And that's what's going on here. And there are plenty of people today who are doing it with real small projects that are beautiful and entertaining. And also preserve stuff in a good state for the future. But that, I think that's the message. That's how we all got started. I got started totally from being in love with the music, and I know Dave did and Chris did too. Did you ever see a guy more passionate than that guy?
That's why we took the mic away from him.
That's it. You can talk about a bunch of other stuff, but that's it. If you love something, go do the project. Don't wait for anything. Just make it happen.
Well, I think that's excellent advice. Now, passion is what you guys are all about, and I know the next panel, same thing. But you got to pay the bills. And that's one of the reasons I wanted to know how your different parts of your businesses supported each other. Also, though, it's not just about the music, is it? I mean, if you all started in the LP era, and you've all successfully moved into the digital era. But it's not just putting out a track. Initially it was the liner notes that explained who this guy was or who these people were, gave them some background, why they were important. CD era, you had booklets, and now we're even moving to books with CDs. So can you talk to me a little bit about how you have over the years approached your presentation or your packaging, and what you were trying to convey in your presentation and packaging?
All right, I'm the first victim. Okay, well, to begin with, I think I was extremely lucky to start in 1960. That was the beginning, really, of acceptance of vernacular music on a fairly large scale due to the many folk festivals that were coming up. And all of a sudden, a lot of youngsters were interested in rural American music, I think that's, as well as urban, that had its roots in the South, I think, you know, the blues in Chicago, etc. It didn't really extend very much to other ethnic groups in this country. It's kind of strange how that never happened, except for Cajun music. That, you know, people either love it or hate it. And I was lucky enough to first encounter a live Cajun band. I think on my first trip to New Orleans, I was driving from Houston to New Orleans, and I asked the guy at the gas station, you know, do you know if any Cajun music? And he told me, well, go to one of those bars at the Four Corners. And I did, and there was a really attractive girl as a bartender. I finally got up my nerve and I asked her, have you ever heard any Cajun music? And she just broke out laughing like hell and said, yeah, just last night me and my boyfriend got drunk and we danced all night at the Midway Club. You can't miss it. It's just a short distance from here on the way to Bro Bridge. And I thanked her, and there I went and saw this amazing band. They were playing my favorite country tune. It wasn't God Who Made Honky Tonk Angels. And they had two singers. One sang in English and one sang in French. And I'll never forget the people dancing around in a counterclockwise circle. And the men were tiny and the women were huge. I'll never forget that. And I said, oh my God, this is music. This is unbelievable. I've never encountered anything like it. Anyway, this is really, you know, I didn't have to go to Africa to explore or kill animals or anything. I just...
So Chris, how did you package that in your CD?
I couldn't. I mean, if I had a camera in my head, you know, like people are going to, the next generation is going to be born with these things in their ears, these pee pods and iPods and piss pods and whatever they got. But I didn't have a camera. It was, you know, I did have a Leica. And so I did take a lot of photographs, since I was usually the only person there when I was recording people. Sometimes I was thankfully with somebody, but I always had to do it myself, and then also wrote the notes myself, since nobody really wanted to write about Zydeco, for example, when I first encountered it in Houston, Texas. It was just this amazing stuff at this. I remember Mac McCormick took me to it. It was just off of Dowling Street, and one after another of these accordion players just... One of them was the father of the Sam Boys that I later recorded. And anyway, I just had to do the best I could by taking notes as to, oh yeah, you were born so and so, and where did this music come from? Well, I don't know. My father played it, and then I asked him how to spell these words. Well, you spell it any way you want to. That's what Clifton Chenier told me when he sang that amazing, on the second session, that wonderful blues that we eventually call Louisiana Blues, because that's exactly what he told me. He jabbered something in French, you know, and it's a good thing I didn't put that on the label, because the DJs probably would have never played it. And I finally asked him, Cliff, can I call it Louisiana Blues? And he thought a minute, go ahead. Call it Louisiana Blues. Right. And that was probably the smartest thing we ever did, because they put that needle down, and oh man, I wish you could hear it. But anyway, it's unbelievable. It's the most low-down blues, and he sings about how every day is the same or is not the same with your old lady. And that was the key to that song. And thank God at that time there were still a lot of Creoles living down there, and it sold pretty good.
Good.
Anyway, I packaged it by putting Clifton Chenier's picture on the cover, and I wrote down when he was born, you know, and all that sort of thing.
Good.
Okay.
So you brought information forward from the source himself, even though he didn't know how to spell it. You said...
Well, who else can you ask?
Exactly. There you go.
This is vernacular history, and you got to keep in mind, even if there's an accident someplace and you have three witnesses, they probably saw it three different ways.
There you go.
Well, that's vernacular history for you. Nobody sees it the same way. It's just amazing. And it changes every day. Every day is not the same.
Right. Or it is. Dave.
It's hard to top that. That really spells it all for Rich and myself. You do get just taken away with, especially the novelty. It's a novelty at first. I first real old time, not old time, but ethnic music or whatever you want to call it. I remember listening to the Hometown Frolics in New Jersey, in WAAT, New Jersey, where I heard country music. It wasn't bluegrass was part of it, but the word bluegrass wasn't used at the time. and just went on from there. You want to fill in for a minute while I...
Sure. Well, your question, Dave, about how you put it all together, a lot of people have done it different ways. At Yazoo, we've done it to the extent of having a 54-page booklet. Mm-hmm. And oddly enough, just a few months ago, we put out a DVD that had early 1950s footage of Bill Monroe in color, yeah. Mm-hmm. And Hank Williams, only known for performances, and the Lumen Brothers, and Sam McCurkin McGee. And the criticism we got because we didn't put notes on there is just, it's astounding and to be silly and depressing. Mm-hmm. You really have to put notes on about who Bill Monroe is, who Hank Williams is. We always thought it was superfluous, whereas in the other case, we had 54 pages of, first of all, entertaining historical mm-hmm. information, mm-hmm. not just piles of information.
Right. Yeah.
That I thought was the appropriate way to do that project.
Yeah.
But there's a very rigid orientation. I don't know whether it's an academic orientation or what, but you must have notes. And the more notes you have, the more notes you have, the better your project is. It could sound like crap. It could be poorly put together. But if you got a bunch of notes,
yeah.
like a big fat booklet, yeah. then you're okay.
Yeah.
I think each. Yeah, I know.
Wait a minute. Before you do. but let me talk about those 54-page booklets.
Yeah.
Because Rich has been kind enough to make sure I have pretty much his entire catalog. And that, you know, when you open up a CD, not only do you get to hear about this performer, but Rich's notes about who he was and telling stories about it, pictures and so forth, is an education right there. It's cornerstone of any person.
I gotta say, it's meant to be more entertaining than educational.
Uh-huh.
You get the education along the way. It's just like, I grew up loving country music, and the more you listen to it, the more educated you become. It's like hitting a baseball.
Uh-huh.
And the more you dive into it, the more educated you become. But you don't have to drag anybody along and say you must get educated. Entertain them. And the notes always should, in my opinion, entertain people. So you just can't wait to turn it like a mystery story or something.
Yeah.
And along the way, you'll pick up a lot of hardcore education here.
The next question I want to ask has to do with sound, the sound itself.
Well, I think we should add one more thing to that.
Of course,
that's
Chris.
The fact that I think Folkways Records was on the scene, and I think they probably influenced most of us in one way or another. I mean, I was definitely influenced by this wonderful black jacket with just a wraparound printed thing, and I did that, actually. I followed that to a T. And also, but then I was impressed by the commercial people who were coming out with, like the Sonny Boy Williamson on Chess, for example, which had this drunken guy on the street. I thought, oh my God, this is really a grabbing picture. But I don't think it was Sonny Boy at all. It was just some drunk that they'd photographed on the street. And on the other hand, some of them had just a pretty girl, like all of the stuff that Modern and RPM put out, those cheap Crown records. And we met, Mr. Bahari there, and he said, yeah, we hired the most expensive photographer in Hollywood, and they found us the prettiest black girls that posed for it. In Latin music, it was always a bikini-clad chick that was on a cover, you know. Otherwise, you might as well forget about the music, every cover almost.
So you agree with Rich, it's about entertainment.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, there you go.
But I don't think we were quite sure what our audience would go for, you know. I was natural. I thought, just get the people that were on the record.
Well, you all are passionate not only about what you do, but the sound itself that you deliver in your products is absolutely critical. I mean, when we started this morning, I don't know if you heard, as soon as the microphone went on, you know, Chris yelled out, turn down the damn bass, you know. So, I mean, these guys are, like, really attuned to sound. Many archivists are taught that, you know, a flat transfer, unplayed with, is the best way to archive, and that is absolutely true. But it's probably one of the worst ways to listen to a record.
The worst way to transfer also.
Let's talk about that.
There's no such thing as a flat transfer. The only way you can have a flat transfer is to know what curve something was recorded in the first place. You know, most things weren't recorded in the RIAA modern LP curves. If you don't know what curve they recorded in, how can you have a flat transfer? It's nonsense.
Mm-hmm.
You have to have the guts to make value judgments. If you're listening to something and you think that certain aspects of it are exciting and important, you're going to stress that in the sound mm-hmm. when you remaster. You want for example, blues artist Frank Stokes, when he recorded in Memphis, he's shouting with his voice, but somehow they're not picking up the guitar at all.
Mm.
Now, you want to have your nice, sanctified, good housekeeping seal of approval of a flat transfer. Good. Give it to the people, they won't hear the guitar.
Mm-hmm.
That's really brilliant. What would be the point of it?
Right.
You want to hear the guitar. So you have to take steps to ensure that you're hearing the guitar as well as the voice. Flat transfer, even if that was possible, wouldn't give that to you.
You do your own restoration and mastering. Mm-hmm. And without getting too technical, tell how you might do that in this case.
Well, in that one case specifically, for me, the most important thing is an old term called riding the gain, where you're just physically, you first of all, you have to learn the tune inside out and backwards so that you know what's coming next, so that you can change the level. He just sang his verse, and you had to bring the level down because he's shouting. Now here comes the guitar too soft. You got to be up to where it needs to be. Before he gets there. Now, you can do this stuff with equipment like limiters, compressors. Personally, I prefer manually because the compression adds an unwelcome coloration to the sound.
Yeah.
But it's like an into technical stuff. It's just, again, it's just a value adjustment. When you're doing it, you want it to, for me, I wanted to communicate the excitement that I feel when I hear the music. So that's what guides everything.
Excellent answer. Excellent answer. Dave?
I'll just second that. And then it was actually several people. I never have been as conscious of sound and what you can do with it. I was more into the music. But I will say that we had, when we put out our first county records, after about four or five of them, we started to hear from people who said, you know, you could improve this, the sound should be a little better. And one of the people who did was Rich Nevins, came and he led me to Nick Pearls, who was doing some mastering and for his own Yazoo label. But I respected him from what I heard other people say, as somebody who knew sound and we could improve by having somebody knowledgeable work on it. So I sort of turned it over, and you know, we got feedback from people all over the country, say, yeah, your records sound better than they used to, and so on.
Chris?
Yeah, I guess I should be talking more about reissues rather than our Hooli recordings. I don't really recall exactly how I did my earliest ones, but I never went to anybody. I just used my turntable and a preamp and an amplifier, and I never bothered with anything as long as the record sounded good. You know, of course, if it was a brand new copy, and Bob Pinson supplied me with a lot of the stuff that I did for especially old-timey records. And and so I never did fool around much with anything. In more recent times, it's really the preamp, I think, is the most important thing, that it has a good sound, you know? And don't cut off the bottom like so many people do. It's terrible. Sounds like tin shit, you know? Huh?
No noise cuts off the bottom. All the computer systems that everybody uses.
I don't use no computers. God damn it.
The bottom when they're so
Yeah.
People are so paranoid about noise that they use modern computer programs like No Noise and Cedar. Cedar is the worst. And maybe it's okay if you have a real expert using it. Most people use too much. And then there's no bass left in the music, and it's like flat and linear, and it doesn't have the punch of excitement. And the music that we do is so full of dynamics and attack that you can't lose that. Although the orientation of everything, for simplicity, it's just to go that route, that simple computer route.
I did have a good person who did our transfer. Is Tom Diamond here? Do you remember his name? You know, the guy down on the peninsula? George Morrow. George Morrow, yeah. Sometimes I had to send it back. I said, George, there's some weird sound here. He used one of those systems, and he overdid it sometimes, and I'd send it back. And I don't know. If you got clean records, just leave them.
We got time for one more round of answers, and you all have seen great changes in the industry itself, from physical, from vinyl to CD, and now to no physical product, digital. How has that changed what you do or how you do it? Do you see a future for reissue projects that are digital only? No babe on the cover.
I think we have tried, haven't we, Tom? We have issued some material from the Ideal label in San Benito that I bought some years ago. It's all Mexican border music. We've issued those in digital format only. Do they sell at all? No, not much. Because those people, they don't like that kind of stuff. They don't have computers and... they still buy CDs at a little store in San Antonio. What's her name's wonderful shop? She still sells CDs, and some of them at premium prices if they're out of print and so forth. It's this constantly inventing of new crap is really hurting the poor people where that music comes from, because they can't afford to buy new damn diddly-doos every 2 minutes, you know? And I think that's what killed the whole thing, I think. This overkill. It's just terrible. They should kill these goddamn inventors.
Hey, Chris, afterwards we're going out for a beer and you're going to tell me what you really think. Okay?
I think what's really hurt reissues is not advanced in technical stuff like downloading or anything else. It's that there are no record stores left in America. We're right back to where we were in 1956 or something. When it was hard to find any eclectic music in a physical record store in America. And we're right back there because there's no Tower, there's no Virgin, there's no Borders. The biggest store in New York, J&R, closed up 3 or 4 weeks ago. And those were the stores that... I think I remember an anecdote when you put out your first reissue. Didn't you get a call from Sam Goody that he wanted to have your records? Do you remember that?
Yeah.
I'll pass the mic to Dave. But people used to be able to go into stores and go like this. Oh, wow, what's this? And discover stuff. And that's not possible anymore. So you have a problem with physical reissues, because where the hell do you put them? Amazon or nothing. And people aren't going to find it on Amazon unless they know to go look for it.
Have you brought back a few memories there with the mention of Sam Goody, which was the big record store in, I think, on 48th Street or 49th and Broadway in New York City. Of course, I lived in the middle of the city, and I could just walk over there, and I checked things out all the time. When they started happening, which was, a little after, I guess, the Harry Smith collection type of thing, there were definitely, we saw some of the Origin. I picked up an Origin jazz record, really the country blues. I found that at Sam Goody, and that was just about the time that you could start seeing things like this. And some of the early bluegrass reissues of Bill Monroe and so on that came out on Harmony label and so on. But I remember when I really was naive when we put out our first record, collection of Mountain Fiddle music on the county label. We pressed 500 of them, and I didn't know exactly where I was going to sell them. And I really wanted to sell them in the South, in the rural area where the music came from, and made some trips down there. And I did find a few places that were interested enough to take 3 copies or 5 copies, whatever it was. But speaking of Sam Goody, I went there, and somebody said, I told the clerks there I had a record that I put out that I'd like to see if Sam Goody wanted to sell. And he was up on some kind of a balcony in the back, and they called him and say, hey, this guy wants. And I will say, within a minute and a half, he looked at the record and said, I'll take 50 of them. And that made the whole thing. And from there on, you know, and they actually reordered some later, too.
Fantastic. Well, thank you very much, all three of you. It's been terrific. Thanks a lot. Appreciate it. Dave, thank you very much. Hope we get a chance to talk. We're going to have a drink. You're going to tell me what you really think, okay? Next group? Yeah, be careful.
I'll take it, please. All right.
Hey, man. How's it going? Good to see you. Yeah. Anywhere you want. I won't ask them to line up by political affiliation as the last three did. Think about that. Richard, Dave Givinoni, great to meet you. Have a seat.
So this is the more important round now.
Well, certainly the second.
We're here to give you hope.
Let's begin again. I think you can introduce yourselves a little better than I can. And tell me your company or companies and basically what you
Who's
do.
Who's
I'm Richard Martin. My partner, Megan Hennessy, and I run Archaeophone Records. We specialize in the acoustic era. So if they recorded it into a horn or on soot black paper, that's what we do. We've done a couple of things from the electrical period, but basically, no.
That's called out, Richard.
That's right. My name is Lance Ledbetter. I run Dusta Digital Records in Atlanta with my wife, April. We've kind of like Rich here. We've gone very far back in the past, all the way up to modern era, and looking forward to this talk. It's hard to follow up the people that were on this. The stage earlier. I just want to say that as a college radio DJ in the 1990s, Yazoo, Arhuli, and County all offered special DJ prices for their CDs, and really owe a big debt to them.
Hi, my name is Richard Weitzer, and I own Bear Family Records in Germany, and I sort of started off as a record collector in. Did make my first records not on Bear Family in the late 60s and started Bear Family Records really in 1975.
As we saw from the pioneers, I guess is the best, nicest term I could use for the three gentlemen before us. As we saw from the pioneers, this is a labor of passion and of love. You're reissuing music, artists that you truly believe in and believe should be heard. How did you make the decision, an audacious decision actually, in a crowded field when you all started, to get into that field? What were you thinking?
Well, I bought my first record when I was 10 years old in 1955 or 1956. It was Bill Haley, Rock Around the Clock. And that was sort of the day when I got addicted, whatever. You know, I just bought records or, you know, listened to records from friends, and record was my only way what I spent my pastime on. And so then I collected records, and I remember I made a built a cabinet for myself for 300 LPs, and when it was nearly done, I already had 500. And I decided it's not good, you know, carrying on, you know, building more cabinets. And so then, you know, from Germany, I moved to England. I didn't have time to collect stuff. And in England, I remember I was driving into town, and suddenly I saw a big sign. I've been always, you know, more basically rock and roll and a country fan of the 50s. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's nothing to do that, you know, Chris or David or Richard sort of were into, because I was sort of the second generation. I was, you know, listening to Jim Reeves and Don Gibson and all that stuff. And I was driving into town. I saw a big billboard, and it says, Wembley Country Festival, Hank Snow. I was just made my day, but he didn't come. Because that was one of the tricky tricks that Mervyn Conder, producer, always advertised artists, which didn't come. But a lot of stuff came. And so, you know, then when I really started collecting again, and then there in England, I made my first records. The first record I ever made was a record by Goebel Reeves, the Texas Drifter. There might be the odd person here who remember who he was. And he, you know, at least if nobody remembers him, he wrote one mind-shaking song, Hobo's Lullaby, that everybody in the folk movement recorded. There's nobody, take Seeger, take Baez, whoever recorded that song. So that was sort of when I initially sort of started. Lance, here
yes.
We go.
Okay. I started in the late 90s. I was a college radio DJ, and like I said, I was listening. The Harry Smith anthology had been reissued in 97 on CD by Smithsonian Folkways, and I just started listening and started working with some different record collectors, and started to going back to something Rich Nevin said about the death of the record store. I was very record store driven in my mentality, you know, going into shops and hearing things from different 78 collectors that you couldn't find in a record shop. And so I was very driven and like David said, passion driven, because it's not a lot to of money to be made in doing this. But you know, I really wanted to make sure you could go into a record shop and find the way I thought of it was access points, you know, places where you could get into music from the past in a way that was digestible and accessible for, you know, people of the 1990s and early 2000s.
My commitment was a little bit different from everybody else's. I enjoy listening to Rich and Chris and Dave and the passion that they had for this music, and in many cases, seeing it performed live with stuff that's 120 years old. We don't have that ability. So it was always an intellectual commitment. And in my case, I was two masters and a PhD program tired of grad school and decided it was time to do something more interesting. But it was always about the research, the history, the culture, the pages of American history that are just forgotten. And that was our passion, was for the culture and the history. And records that a lot of people would like to forget or have destroyed altogether. From a product point of view, our guiding principle was we'd like to buy it ourselves. You know, we came online. I mean, some people talk about, wouldn't it have been great to have been around in the LP era when you could print big and have nice big pictures and things like that? Well, I mean, I was transitional there. I mean, I collected LPs as a kid, but fully embraced CDs in the 80s. And we saw this as a great opportunity. It was cheaper to do CDs than LPs. Mm-hmm. And you could cram a lot of information in there, small, but you could put a lot in there. And we wanted it to be top-notch. So many of the reissues from the major labels in the 80s and 90s were so terrible, right? The album you bought in the 60s or 70s that had, you know, terrific liner notes or pictures or whatever, when they put it out on CD, all that was gone. And we said, this is a ripoff. We're not going to do that to people. So that has always been at the forefront of our mind. Even when we're doing a very simple package, it's got to be something where people feel like they're getting a value. It's got to be something we would want to own ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Keep the mic, Rich, because then we'll work the other way on this question. To many people, making an audio track accessible has to do with requisition slips and metadata and words that Chris Strachowicz would use there. For you, making music accessible is producing a product that will sell that you want yourself. Talk to us a little bit about with the process. How do you decide what to reissue? How do you do it? How do you decide if you have a critical mass or not, or if you have too much, what to include and exclude? How do you contextualize it in the notes? How do you market it? I mean, it's a huge question. You can answer any of those parts that you want, but I would just want to get a sense.
Well, a lot of what was guiding us for many years was that as we were establishing our niche and people were following us, they trusted us. So we could, get our passion for an artist or a genre or something like that. And people would say, okay, if you say I should hear that, I got to have it. Things are changing. Our customer base, a lot of older people, they've gone on. And with more people buying downloads and wanting one item at a time, it's a little more challenging. And the push lately, as you alluded to earlier, seems to be toward bigger packages, more deluxe packages, beautiful packages like Lance and Richard make. And it's got to be an intellectual or critical problem that we're interested in addressing. That's probably the biggest question.
Give an example. That's a bit abstract at the moment. I mean, like AO or something. You know.
Well, okay. So with actionable offenses, we had this situation where got these one of a kind filthy cylinders at the Edison National Historic Site, and the folks there at Edison had been barraged with requests to release these sounds, and they were concerned about them getting out and not being contextualized. So we partnered with them and showed them that we were going to put this out responsibly. It was going to have entertaining notes, but also very informative, very scholarly notes that were going to contextualize the things and going to put the history around them.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Lance?
It makes people feel good about buying the smut.
Yeah.
I agree a lot with what he said about the building the audience. I think that's something that we've always tried to do over since we started. The first release we put out came out 11 years ago, and we've tried to maintain that relationship with our audience and really seeing them as the core of what makes our business work. We've also in recent years sort of made, as the record industry kind of goes down, we've kind of straddled another industry going down with the book industry, and we've got, double down, I guess. But we do a lot of projects now where we try to, make it where we can have a book distributor carry it and also a record distributor. And, that's something that's working for now, but who knows how long that will last. Does that answer your question?
It's a good answer.
Okay.
Well, first of all, when I started releasing records, I just released what I liked myself. and eventually did build up a sort of number of customers, friends, freaks who just trusted me what, you know, what I released, and if I said it's good or not, you know, they accepted what I thought is okay. There came a time when one of them, it came later, he's sitting there, Rainer Lotz, who brought me some stuff where I didn't have a clue what I was talking about. Mm-hmm. My interest always has been in historical issues and put out, you know, stuff in a historical context. We, in one of the first bigger projects on CD only, not on LP, was Songs of the Protest, which Dave Samuelson and Ron Cohen filed up. Rainer did the Black Eurobox, just recently came out at the end of last year. And putting out stuff which really shows the history of things. I just as an example, which is basically pop music, at one time I had this idea to put out the complete Doris Day, because I thought, well, this is the sort of the typical American 50s, not attitude, but the 50s show how the times were and her music was. So, you know, I did a number of things which I personally didn't really like that very much, but there were others. And then it was always not difficult, but we always tried to find people who knows more than anybody else. And in many cases, you really need, for the writer, he needs to be a good writer, and he also needs to be a nut like myself, because I think only the nuts are the ones who keep the world alive and not the regular ones, you know. So, Go ahead.
I was going to ask you to address the issue of sound. The same question I asked the previous panel. You all you're all very familiar with digital restoration and processing. How do you use it? How do you not use it? What are your aesthetics?
Okay, as far as the sound goes on those reissues, I mostly did reissues. And so, first of all, I made my way into the studios and archives of the major labels. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to see the tape that I was using, if it was a first generation, a second generation, or, you know, it was the original tape. Mm-hmm. So that was the first thing. And so I've been, I think, very, very good on that. And then I always had engineers. I only hear on one ear. I lost hearing on one ear, so I'm not really very good. And one of the best engineers in the old days, unfortunately, he died, didn't he, John? Bob Jones in England, you know, I mean, he was really a guide. Mm-hmm. He came up and he did a very, very good job. Mm-hmm. And now we are running into this problem with CEDA and Sonic Solution. I remember, you know, in the early day, you know, when it just came up, one couldn't afford it. It was so expensive. They charged something like £300 a minute or a half an hour. It was just ridiculous. And Bob and I, we went to EMI in London, and they had one. I mean, not really anybody had. And we went there, and then we decided we're not going to use it, because the sound just isn't good. You know, the point is not getting, and this is the trouble, what Richard already said, that trying to get the noise away. I mean, on the account that the music is dead. Mm-hmm. You see, what you really need, you need the excitement of the music, and if you really kill it, it's no good. It just doesn't listen. It doesn't sound good. Mm-hmm. And so we always then, later years, we found a way. Right now I've got this engineer in Berlin, Christian Zwark. He sort of, and this is the important thing, and Rainer can confirm that, he works for himself regardless who pays him. You know, he takes a day for a song if he feels, even if he doesn't get paid for it, mm-hmm. because he just want to get a good job done. Same with layout people. And, you know, that is as far as the sound goes. And this, I suppose, is with you as well. Here we go.
Well, looking at 78 reissues, you know, you always want to start with the absolute best condition copy of the record to remaster from as possible. And, you know, our audio engineer sitting here, I see him today, Mike Graves, here from Atlanta, who runs Osiris Studios. And Mike and I have been working together on the sound of the Dusted Digital releases for 9 years, something like that. And we started just basically going back and forth, you know, trying to figure out what level of noise we wanted to keep, what we didn't. And it was a long process, but now I feel so confident in what Mike does. And a lot of what we've done, too, with 78 reissues, a lot of times the collector will be, you know, in a very far-off place. And so what Mike has done with a lot of collectors is help them set up. There's a big difference between a transfer station and a listening station. So he's been able to equip a lot of collectors and educate them how to get the best transfers possible so that Mike is receiving the digital files in as close to the condition as he would do himself in his own studio. And as far as Cedar goes, I do know Mike uses some Cedar and some EQ, but I feel like a point that Rich Nevins made is if you've got an expert using Cedar, I think it can be used effectively, but it definitely can be overused. And I think it built a bad reputation early on when it first came out because people were abusing it and making some pretty bad sounding reissues. So
you feel like you've got a character to your sound now, right? That it took you a while to get to.
Yeah. I mean, I think you know, again, several of the people on the panel earlier, you know, that the sound that they when they would reissue things, you know, there's certain sounds you hear, and to me, the best sounding reissue is kind of when the noise sounds the same throughout. And like you early on in the listening experience, you sort of, your ears adapt. Exactly. You establish a floor, and after that first track, maybe halfway into that first track, you don't even notice the noise is there. And that's a challenge because you've got music coming from a lot of different sources, you know, different pressing companies, different recording companies. And so you've got all these things that make that very difficult to do. But when done right, I think a reissue can sound just as good as something made, you know, last week.
Yeah. When we go to shows and conferences and talk to people who collect the type of material that we're interested in from the earliest days of recording, they say, oh, I don't mind a little noise. That's no problem. You should, you know, don't go too far. Well, I'm here to tell you, the public does not want unrestored acoustic recordings, discs, cylinders, or otherwise. It is a no seller. So, I mean, electrics have charm, you know, a little crackle, you know, a little fuzz. Isn't that quaint? There's a roar of noise that we have to deal with. And in the early days of the company, I stepped too hard on the pedal, and Dave Freeman was saying, you know, we learned from that. And like Mike and Lance, you know, we've landed on a sound that we're really, really happy with, and it's better than ever. The tools are better than ever. You don't have to buy Cedar. There are a lot of other products that are very reasonable for serious people. And the things you can do with them are astounding. So, you know, just as the CD has been declared dead, things have gotten really exciting.
Well, let's go out with that discussion. What is the state today, and where is this market going? You painted the picture of riding down on two nuclear bombs, you know, with your hat in the air. But seriously, what's your experience with downloads or for the dead people, uploads only? And, you know, where is it going?
Well, let's see. You know, I definitely see the distributors' accounting is going down. I mean, it's just less record stores to sell to. I think, you know, a lot goes back to just having a built-in customer base and kind of like what Richard was saying, where if they're on board with you, they're going to be right there along for the ride. And trying to maintain that relationship, and my wife and I, we do a lot of direct-to-customer sales. And I think, You know, I think maybe as it gets more and more niche-oriented, it's those customers that have been with you for the ride. I mean, to me, they're the most reliable. As far as downloads go, I think, you know, when you're putting together the nice notes and the nice packages, it's very hard for that to that experience to be on an iPad. It's just very different. But, you know, we're also open-minded to that, and you can put a lot of dynamic information into an iBook. So, I mean, that's something to weigh in the future. It'll be interesting to see if that's a format that people really start to enjoy what we do in that format.
Have you done any experimentation in that?
We have. We did our first iBook with as a partnership with the Library of Congress. It was the 1938 Michigan field trip that Alan Lomax made. And the last year was the 75th anniversary, and they didn't have enough time to put together a book before all these events started. So we tried it with the iBook, and right now the data is too, you know, too early to really see if people are going to adapt to that. We did feel some blowback with, oh, it's iPad or Mac only. So we've done a PDF version, but then you've got all these little pieces. You know, you download it and you've got your PDF, your video files, your MP3s, and it's all, you know, the iBook is all one way to, you know, in one embedded file. But at the same time, how many people are going to make a playlist on an embedded file and listen to? It's just a different experience.
I think everybody is willing to roll with the punches. You know, we're still really excited about what we're doing, and we want to give people what they want. I do think, like our esteemed colleagues were saying, you know, there's a bit of a pendulum. You know, what's going on right now is sometimes a little discouraging. You know, do we really need to put it on something this big? But I talk to young people, and they're getting tired of it too. So, you know, wait it out a little bit and see where it goes. You have to be smart about what you choose to put the most money behind, obviously. Lesser projects, you know, you do more sensibly and save the money for the stuff that you really care about.
I think that, personally, I think that one should have some product in our hands. May it be LPs or, you know, vinyl in one way or another way, or if you want to have less, you still get the CD, which I personally do not like. It's myself for my own collector's choice. I got a question earlier yesterday from Tim Brooks. Why don't I put out the 44 CD box on Black Europe on flash, on a flash drive? I mean, I might as well don't put it out at all. You know, it's just a waste of time. In addition, you know, they put, you know, that was put out, the Paramount box, you know, was issued on a flash drive, 800 songs. Instead of having a decent quality, most of the quality is junk. It's unlistenable. You see, I rather spend all the money and the documentation, which also is good in that particular box. But first of all, we have on the Black Europe box, we have two books, which included to the 44 CDs, which have 650 pages, LP size, and that's a sight to see. And most of my boxes, I mean the early ones, which I really did first, the booklets aren't, or the books aren't that good because, you know, I wasn't experienced as that. Right now, most of the books in the LP size boxes are, you know, hardcover books. Now we just did, you know, the history on the Spanish Civil War, which has a 300-page book. Mm-hmm. And that is sort of fascinating. The music, get the decent quality in the music, the best as possible, and getting a documentation in the book, get good writers who know about the subject and present something. At the end of the day is my philosophy. I put something out which is important, and if the public doesn't want to buy it, I simply say idiots, and that'll be the end of that
story.
There you
go.
Generally go ahead and say, okay, I issue something because people want it, and I, you know, meet their demand. I think that's wrong. First of all, you have to have the best possible, you know, product available, and that's the first goal. If both meet together, that's fine. Mm-hmm. And there were times. I mean, the times are getting less because the customers are getting older. Younger people are, what you just asked, getting into downloads, which to me is a waste of time. I don't even have a cell phone because I can't, you know, and an iPod, I just don't know what it is, and I don't want one, and, you know, I'm just old-fashioned like Chris, you know, although he has a cell phone. I know.
But he's still learning how to use it. Well, the great thing, one of the great things about ARSC is that it allows the public sector folks to speak with the private sector folks. And this morning, I think the discussion we had from the commercial side of the industry, who's been doing this as long or longer than many people in the room have been alive, have taught me a great deal. And I hope it's inflamed your passion to go back and make more sounds accessible to more people. So thank you very much.
Okay, thanks a lot.